Welcome to History Here and Now. I'm Thomas, the voice inside your podcast machine, and today is a great day to learn about history. The History Here and Now podcast is dedicated to bringing you great stories from the past. Here we talk about people, places, events, culture, and practically every other facet involved with history. Does it sound complicated? Well, history is just that, complicated, but it doesn't have to be. I'm here to help break things down and make history more fun, so let's get started. Now, today's episode comes from a special request that we've got from one of my followers on Twitter. The episode considering the isolationism practiced by Japan, a period known as Sakoku. Now, you may have noticed this from a previous blog post that I had written on the website for History Here and Now, but today I decided to delve into it as a podcast, because this period of Japanese history is intriguing to me in that how for years maintained a period of isolationism despite the heavy colonization and mercantile efforts from Western Europe, and how Japan itself inherited a lot of its cultural institutions and learning institutions from mainland China, but then still entered into a period of isolationism. So this will be an interesting topic to go over today. Now, global commerce powered the economies of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Mechanized march of the Industrial Revolution redefined how societies managed and engaged with local economies. Now, Europe was at the forefront of this development, and international trade grew exponentially. Now, they were exploring new markets in the Americas, Africa, and Asia, and these fueled much of these expanding industries. Now, save for one nation who, for over 200 years, actually enforced a harsh government policy of isolation and discouraging foreign intervention. Now, when this practice ended, however, the evolution from feudal society to mechanized constitutional monarchy was one of the fastest in human history. And this transition happened in the home of the Divine Emperor, Japan. Now, foreign relations in Japanese history have a very, let's say, eclectic pattern. Now, the adjacent neighbors like China, the Ryukyu Islands, Koreas, these all had significant impacts on Japanese culture, religion, social class, even down to things like their eating habits. These connections stretched back, thousands and thousands of years following the introduction of Confucianism and the development of the Japanese language based on the framework of the Chinese language. And of course, if you want to learn more about how the Chinese influences in Japan, there are a variety of great resources out there for you to check out. Now, beginning in 1543, a group of Portuguese sailors and merchants were among the first Europeans to set foot in Japan, and they were also responsible for the introduction of firearms. Firearms themselves becoming a game changer during this time in 16th century Japan, when they would be eventually used during the various daimyos and warlords expanding their territory and eventually leading to the reunification of Japan. The following 60 years saw a frantic amount of European trade, piracy, and Christian missionary work. Catholic missions actively proselytized in areas like Kyushu, which is in southwestern Japan. They attracted thousands of converts a year. But the rise of the Tokugawa shogunate in 1600 promptly halted foreign influence following their emergence as supreme military leaders of Japan. The Christianity and European sects were seen primarily as subversive threats to the shogun's stability and to the divinity of the emperor. Now, with the end of the Sengoku period, which also known as the Age of the Warring States, and the beginning of the new Edo period, the new imperial government took numerous measures solidifying domestic control, and one policy was the aforementioned Sakoku. Defined in Japanese as closed country, Sakoku outlined isolationist policies dictating who could leave or enter Japanese islands and control where they operated. Now, selected text from the seclusion edict, which established Sokoku, reads as the following, quote, "No Japanese ship, nor any native of Japan, shall presume to go out of the country. Whoever acts contrary to this shall die, and the ship with the crew and goods aboard shall be sequestered until further orders. All persons who return from abroad shall be put to death. Whoever discovers a Christian priest shall have a reward of 400 to 500 sheets of silver, and for every Christian in proportion. All Namban, mentioned as Portuguese and Spanish, who propagate the doctrine of the Catholics or bear this scandalous name, shall be imprisoned in the Onra, or common jail of the town. The whole race of the Portuguese with their mothers, nurses, and whatever belongs to them shall be banished to Macau. Whoever presumes to bring a letter from abroad or to return after he hath been banished shall die with his family. Also, whoever presumes to intercede for him shall be put to death. No nobleman nor any soldier shall be suffered to purchase anything from the foreigner." Well, for an edict like that, that definitely seems to cover all the bases. You can't go anywhere, don't interact with anyone, don't even try to, you know, leave Japanese waters. Oh, and even if other people in your family just so happen to interact with them, they're all going to be put to death. So there's kind of no more draconian act of isolationism that ever existed in the country at that time. But commerce was the principal focus. So it wasn't mostly centering on things like Christianity or just the mere act of socializing with foreigners. Commerce was the express point that the Tokugawa government wanted to emphasize with this edict. There are four main points of entry were designated to regulate the frequency and national origin of foreign merchants visiting Japan. And officially, the Dutch East India Company was considered the only European entity authorized to conduct business inside Japan. Now, of course, this greatly benefited the Dutch, as it secured a monopoly on all Japanese exports delivered to Europe. Nagasaki was the busiest port, as both Dutch and Chinese vessels conducted trade. Nagasaki became a much more cosmopolitan city than others on the Japanese islands. They offered goods from foreign nations. It was the main exposure of Japanese culture to the Europeans. Of course, Europeans in this case being just the Dutch. But trade goods weren't the only items exchanging hands during Sokoku. Information on foreign nations were also commonplace. So they weren't only exchanging, they weren't just exchanging goods, they were also exchanging ideas. Now, the Japanese government had built a rudimentary picture of other European and Asian nations through the Dutch and to the occasional Korean merchants and diplomats. So if they ever wanted to know something about the outside world, this was the point of information. Now, historical debate over why this isolationist policy was enforced for the duration of the shogunate, that continues well into the present day. A traditional argument states that outside influences like Westernization and Christian missionary work were all undermining the authority of the central government. Now, there had already been a couple of, you know, civil isolated incidents of civil unrest between, you know, recent Japanese converts to Christianity, and smaller groups or families or clans would be deemed as armed religious groups that did eventually become a significant threat during the Sengoku period. And one of the largest outbreaks was the Shimabara Rebellion in 1637. Today, many people support one of these arguments as, of course, one of the sole reasons why Christianity was considered outlawed or anathema to Japanese doctrine. Now, Tokugawa officials applied much similar logic to Christians as they did to Buddhist monks that formed militias to battle local lords during the Sengoku period. So they feared, you know, Christians would instigate rebellions, and Christianity and Western influence were therefore identified as one and the same according to the government and European nations like the Spanish and Portuguese, they were routinely targeted and then expelled from Japan. Now, this did not, of course, eliminate Christianity from the Japanese islands completely, though. Catholic groups formed underground societies called Karuke Kishishitan during the Edo period as a result. And their efforts were helped to keep a small amount of Christianity alive, and they endured for almost 200 years until in 1871, during the Meiji Restoration, religious freedom legislation was passed to all groups. Christianity by then was deemed to be a protected religion within Japan, and it was no longer legal to persecute them based completely on their faith. Now, in some pop culture references, you may have, seen instances like this. If you've seen the 2016 film Silence with Liam Neeson and Andrew Garfield, it follows a group of missionaries who are trying to find another Portuguese missionary within Japan. Or if you are really into pop culture and following things like Japanese anime, if you've seen the series Samurai Champloo, you discover at the end of the series that one of the female lead characters' father, by the name of Fu, she discovers that her father was part of the Shimabara Rebellion, and that's why, he ended up having to abandon her because he believed that she was going to be a target from the shogunate. So, now, isolationism was not the ultimate aim of Sokoku, however, as historians then will claim later. By controlling foreign imports and contact with outside nations, the Tokugawa government exercise greater control over the local lords, known as daimyos. This would increase their domestic power. You could limit international commerce to strictly monitored ports. You could see what was coming in. You could see what was leaving. You could monitor the people that were conducting these trades. And the shogun controlled basically what came into the country and what could then pass into the hands of the daimyos. Now, this practice greatly diminished the daimyo's power, as they previously relied on trade with the Chinese mainland to generate income during the Sengoku or Warring States period. This is what gave many of them a lot of power and the resources in order to continue controlling their own personal fiefdoms and war against other lords. But now, without this vital link to the mainland, no daimyo could become powerful enough to challenge the shogun. Combined with this rationale was forcing the daimyos to rotate their residence at the Edo capital for a year in practice, which was called Senkin Kotai. By alternating residences in the capital with the shogun, the daimyos could be monitored and were placed under further control of the shogun. Now, if all this was about, not just about we hate foreigners, was not about, we hate foreigners, we don't want anything to interact with the Chinese or any European nations, this is a much more practical political tool that the Tokugawa government used, and essentially, and it worked for over 200 years. Now, eventually, challenges to Sokoku were brought up throughout the Edo period as Japanese nobility and European powers attempted to curtail or abolish the edict and try to introduce full integration of foreign contacts. But this doesn't mean that the Japanese were completely ignorant of what was happening in the world. They did keep themselves informed of world affairs through Dutch mediators, but European businesses were still forbidden from operating inside Japan. There was a spree of Russian, British, French, and U.S. and United States ships visiting different islands, requesting permission to trade or establish embassies, but these were all denied. And now world events like the Napoleonic Wars and eventually the Opium Wars did result in minimal alterations to the policy, such as allowing ships to dock and resupply. But the real watershed moment occurred on July 8, 1853, with the arrival of Commodore Matthew Perry and his four warships, the Mississippi, Plymouth, Saratoga, and Susquehanna. Now, Perry's arrival and his role in opening Japanese doors to the West has always been under some sort of scrutiny, pretty much since the 1850s. Many people see him as the herald for bringing Japanese into the modern era. Others say that, you know, his tactfulness was the key to breaking the Japanese. Others say that he was just a complete brute. And there are also others that say, you know, there was much more going on and Japan was already going to open and Perry's arrival was just kind of like, eh, okay, now's the time. But in summary, to give a brief overview, his arrival and subsequent demand for opening trade between Japan and the United States was one of the first steps in actually dismantling Sokoku and opened the path for other nations. And a year later, the Convention of Kanagawa and the signing of what was called Treaty of Peace and Amity, it would pave the way for economic relations and eventually the end of Japanese isolationism. But what can't be ignored, though, is that as European nations finally established relations with Japan, there became a spree of highly unequal trade treaties and economic agreements, which was a result of this gunboat diplomacy. Terms and conditions like these remained a sticking point for the Japanese, who feared encroaching imperialist conditions on their homeland. Now, they also then understood that while the rest of the world was industrialized, they would have to catch up as well in order to, what they believe, you know, interact with on equal footing. An industrialized West and rapidly changing domestic settings finally forced the fall of the Tokugawa shogunate and signaled the beginning of the Meiji Restoration. And then, as a result, with the establishment of the new Meiji government in the mid-19th century, and eventually at the dawn of the 20th century, the Japanese made that dramatic transition from what many historians describe as a feudal state to a modern powerhouse nation, industrialized nation, at the beginning of the 20th century. This was one of the most dramatic changes, but coming from a period when the nation itself was closed off for over 200 years, they were just as eager to expand out and basically announce themselves on the world stage. Now, I really hope you enjoyed that story. History Here and Now is a website dedicated to the research and writing about different historical topics. If you like this podcast, hit the like button, share it on social media, recommend it to your friends, families, colleagues, and anyone you think would enjoy hearing a good history discussion. You can follow History Here and Now on Twitter and check back periodically for the next episode. Until then, good luck, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.